TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. How the West Caused the Crisis in Ukraine. Part 3. Questions and Answers with Professor John Mersheimer. This is an urgent appeal to pay attention to the crisis in Ukraine. The two largest nuclear powers, the US and Russia, are in direct and escalating confrontation. John Mersheimer is professor of political science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. In the two preceding programs, you heard him along with Rick Russoff, anti-war activist and manager of the Stop NATO website. They spoke about what they see as the causes of the war in Ukraine and put much of the blame on the U.S. and the dramatic expansion of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Mersheimer states emphatically that in the prevailing opinion in the West, the Ukraine crisis is blamed almost entirely on Russian aggression. But this account is wrong, says Mersheimer. The United States and its European allies share most of the responsibility for the crisis. All questions in the upcoming Q&A period are addressed to Professor Mersheimer. They range from who engineered the coup in February 2014 to what's the role of the neo-Nazis. The first question was, are the Russians running out of petrodollars? And do they need to blink on sanctions? Professor Mersheimer.
This is actually a very important question. And his question boils down to this. Will the economic punishment that we are inflicting on the Russians, and by the way, that economic punishment is not only due to sanctions, it's also due, in fact, it's due more so to the drastic drop in world oil prices. That more than the sanctions is hurting the Russians, but it's a double whammy, okay? So his question is, will that economic pain, that punishment, cause Putin and the Russians to throw up their hands and concede defeat to the West? And what this really all...
Will they keep forces in the field?
Well, they'll be able to keep forces in the field. The point is that those forces will be somewhat diminished. And to maintain those forces in the field, they'll have to rob Peter to pay Paul, right? And that will cause more economic hardship at home, right? What this really all boils down to is how you think a country that believes it faces an existential threat or feels that its security, its core security is threatened, will behave in the face of economic punishment. And the historical record, in my opinion, makes it absolutely clear that countries that feel their core strategic interests are at stake will pay an enormous economic price and will not throw their hands up. So I think there is little reason to believe that the economic pain that's being inflicted on the Russians, even if it continues, will cause them to throw up their hands because strategic interests are at stake. Core strategic interests are at stake. And basically what that means is your survival's at stake. Rick was talking about the possibility of nuclear weapons being used. I agree with everything he said. But the mere fact that he's talking about nuclear weapons being used, just the mere fact that he mentioned it, that I mentioned it, that Mikhail Gorbachev mentioned it, that tells you that the Russians are really serious here. And by the way, Putin mentioned the subject of nuclear weapons right after the crisis began. He reminded the West that I have nuclear weapons, right? And I do not think all of the economic punishment we can inflict on them, which is considerable, will get them to throw their hands up.
The next person asked Professor Mersheimer, what's the role of the U.S. in the February 2014 coup in Ukraine? And wasn't Crimea historically part of Russia?
I think almost everybody agrees that Crimea was historically a part of Russia and that in 1954, Nikita Khrushchev, some reason, decided to give Ukraine Crimea as a birthday present. And because Ukraine and Russia were then both part of the Soviet Union, and nobody in 1954 was thinking that the Soviet Union was going to disappear and there would be an independent Ukrainian and Russian state, it was not a very meaningful gesture. And the reason that it was relatively easy for Russia to take Crimea and justify it was because the majority of people in Crimea are Russian and wanted to become part of Russia and abandon Crimea. Your first question is, what was American participation in the events leading up to and including the February 22nd coup? It's really hard to get your hands around the details on this because most of the details haven't come out. But it's very clear that Victoria Nuland, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for Eastern Europe, and John McCain, just to pick two people, actually participated in the protests. Furthermore, it's very clear that the United States had upped the amount of resources that it was funneling to the opposition to Yanukovych in 2013 and in early 2014. We were funding the opposition. It's also clear that Victoria Nuland and the Americans more generally were working with the people who then came to power after Yanukovych was disposed, and that they had made it clear, we know this from intercepted telephone conversations, that they wanted to see the people who are now running Ukraine in power. So our fingerprints are there. The extent to which we were involved is hard to tell. My guess is, and this is just a guess, is that once we get all the information, and this may take 20 or 30 years, but once we get all the information, you'll see major American involvement.
That was Professor John Mersheimer answering questions at a January 2015 event in Chicago. The next person said, "My understanding is that after the Russian Revolution, the Ukrainians suffered a lot and welcomed the Nazis as liberators, and even fought with them against the Soviets. How much of that plays into this crisis?"
With regard to the historical story here, there's no question that the Soviet Union did absolutely horrible things to the Ukrainian people after the Russian Revolution. I don't know that it was the Russians doing that to the Ukrainians, and indeed Stalin himself was a Georgian, not a Russian. Furthermore, with regard to the German invasion of the Soviet Union, the Germans in World War II were probably the most murderous people in modern history, and they murdered huge numbers of Ukrainians and Belarusians. They murdered anybody they could get their hands on, to put it bluntly. So it wasn't like it was the Ukrainians and the Germans against the Russians or against the Soviets. There were certainly some Ukrainians who fought with the Germans, but it was hardly anything like all the people. Now, there's no question that inside Ukraine today, there is a powerful nationalism, and they are proud of their state, the Ukrainian state, and many of the people in that state would like to be part of the West, and they don't want to be in Russia's orbit. And I believe that, more than the history, is what's driving this crisis, right? And when I give the talk that you just heard, people often say to me, "Don't the Ukrainians have a right to have a foreign policy of their own?" And this is an argument that, of course, resonates in the West, where we place a very high premium on rights. And because we respect the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian state, most people are very sympathetic to the argument that they should have the right to side with the West if they see fit. My response to that is they don't have that right, and it's foolish to talk in those terms. Cuba did not have the right to jump into bed with the Soviet Union militarily from our point of view. We now do not recognize Taiwan's right to declare its independence. Anytime you live next door to a guerrilla, it's very foolish to talk in terms of rights. What you want to do is pay very serious attention to the guerrilla and make sure that you don't do anything to antagonize that guerrilla so that the guerrilla crushes you. The Ukrainians, are in a very precarious strategic situation. They have what I call bad geography. When you have bad geography, you have to be very careful. And this is why I said I think that Western leaders, to include American leaders, are leading the Ukrainians down the primrose path by talking about rights and telling them that they can become part of NATO if they want to. The end result of encouraging that kind of rhetoric is to ruin Ukraine. And I believe that these people in Washington and in Western capitals who purport to be Ukraine's friends are not Ukraine's friends. And the argument that I'm making is friendly to the Ukrainians. It is pro-Ukrainian.
The next question for Professor Mersheimer was, does the U.S. have economic reasons for intervening in Ukraine?
I assume that what you're getting at is the belief that the United States has economic reasons for encouraging Ukraine to become part of the West. I don't believe that's the case. I think there's no doubt that the United States has economic interests in Ukraine, but I don't think it was necessary to peel Ukraine away from Russia's orbit to realize those economic gains. And I think what's really happening here economically is that not only is Ukraine being wrecked, Russia is being seriously damaged, and I believe that this is going to blow back into the European Union. I would suggest that all of you over the next year, just read very carefully, whether you read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, or whatever, read all the articles on why the European Union is in trouble these days and what the prospects are for the future. And almost every article says that the economic problems being caused by the Ukraine crisis are hurting the economic situation in Western Europe. This is why the German business elites are adamantly opposed to sanctions being imposed on the Russians. And they are telling Merkel loudly and clearly that if she continues to ramp up the sanctions, even maintain the present sanctions on Russia, this is going to blow back and do damage to the European Union. And you all know that the European Union, because of the euro crisis, is in deep trouble anyway, independent of what's going on in Ukraine. So I think, if anything, right, by precipitating this crisis and then doubling down, which has been our policy, to double down instead of backing off and rethinking what we're doing, we're making the economic situation for Russia, Ukraine, and Western Europe worse. And that is not to our benefit, because we need a strong international economy to make our economy, the American economy, grow.
Another person in the audience asked Professor Mersheimer, does the U.S. foreign policy elite want to go to war with China? And who's Obama's national security advisor?
His national security advisor is Susan Rice, and probably the most prominent member of his administration on the foreign policy front is John Kerry. He really doesn't have a Secretary of Defense now, but I think John Kerry is the public face of the administration outside the president himself. It's very interesting. I have no good feel for who made policy on Ukraine up to the February 22nd coup, and I have no good sense, and I've talked to lots of people, as to who's driving the train since February 22nd. There's this woman, Victoria Nuland, who I mentioned before, who's the Assistant Secretary of State for Eastern European Affairs. She's a very key player in the events before February 22nd or leading up to February 22nd. But I don't have a good sense of who she was reporting to, who was monitoring her. There are a number of people I know who think that she was sort of a lone wolf. She was kind of on her own. And one of the problems here is that we're so bogged down in our wars in the Middle East or in the greater Middle East that Obama doesn't have much time to spend thinking about Ukraine. And this is what allowed her to have all the freedom to formulate policy that she apparently had. There are also people, just for your information, who argue that what has happened with regard to Ukraine is that the Americans have sort of turned the portfolio over to Angela Merkel, that we're relying very heavily on the Germans to deal with the Russians, and not to manage this problem, but to take the lead in a very subtle and sophisticated kind of way, because we're pinned down. When you're a global superpower like the United States and you're trying to run the world, right, you oftentimes have to outsource problems. And there are people who argue, I don't know whether it's true for sure, that the Germans are doing a lot of the heavy lifting with regard to Ukraine, and that's why it's hard to see the fingerprints of a Susan Rice or a John Kerry. But I would just say as a general point, I don't have a good feel for who's behind our policy up to the coup and then after the coup. With regard to your first question, which is a fascinating question, I was in Japan for 10 days in December. And as you know, Hillary Clinton had announced in 2011 that we're going to pivot to Asia. And the pivot to Asia is all about the fact that we care greatly about the rise of China, and we're thinking that we have to be there to back up our allies in Asia. And this, of course, includes the Japanese, the South Koreans, the Filipinos, Taiwanese, Vietnamese, and so forth and so on. But the Japanese view is, number one, you can't pivot to Asia if you start a war against ISIS in the Middle East, and then you cause a crisis in Eastern Europe that's going to cause you to redouble your efforts in Europe to contain Russia, if you start doing all the things that Rick was concerned about, right? So number one, the pivot to Asia is not looking very good from a Japanese point of view, which scares them. Second, it raises all sorts of questions about America's judgment. Number three, and this gets at your point, it drives the Russians into the arms of the Chinese. And from a Japanese point of view, they would prefer the Russians to be allied with the Japanese and the Americans against the Chinese in the future. But exactly the opposite is happening. And then finally, the Japanese are very concerned about getting back the Kuril Islands that they lost after World War II, that the Russians now control. And the Japanese thought they were making significant progress with Putin and with the Russians more generally on getting those islands back. And they believe that because the Americans are now leaning on them, we're leaning on the Japanese to be tough with the Russians, they're not going to get the Kuril Islands back, right? So I think that your basic point about the geostrategic consequences of what's happening with regard to Ukraine on our Asian policy or on geopolitics in Asia is correct. And if you were to go to Japan, you would find people talking there much the way you were talking. The United States and the West Europeans have been playing tough with the Russians almost since the breakup of the former Soviet Union. He was also talking about missile defense in Eastern Europe, which is another one of those issues that just drives the Russians up a tree. Libya, by the way, is another case, right? They went along with us on Libya in 2011, thinking it was designed to protect innocent Libyans from being murdered. And then we used the UN resolution that came out of the Security Council basically to overthrow Gaddafi. And this enraged the Russians, and it's why they wouldn't play ball with us on Syria.
That's Professor John Mersheimer. The next question was, what about the neo-Nazis involved in the current government in Ukraine?
One point that I didn't bring up in my comments, just because of time considerations, is that it is clear that there were fascists, I mean real fascists, involved in the opposition to Yanukovych, and that a number of those fascists then held important positions in the government that replaced the Yanukovych government. Second point I'd make is that one problem that Americans have is they have little sense of history, their own history and certain other people's history. But in 1917, Russia dropped out of World War I. It lost the war. It was invaded by Germany. It suffered a catastrophic defeat. In World War II, thankfully, it won the war. The Soviet Union played the key role in defeating Nazi Germany. It was not the United States. As I like to tell students, when we landed on the Normandy beaches on June 6, 1944, less than 1 year before the war ended, at that point in time, 93% of all German casualties were on the Eastern Front. 93% were on the Eastern Front. To defeat Nazi Germany in World War II involved a huge bloodletting. Whoever played the key role in defeating Nazi Germany would pay a god-awful blood price. Right, and that was the Soviet Union. They lost 24 million people. 16 million of those people were civilian, and of the 8 million military deaths, 3.3 were POWs who were murdered by the Germans. Right, so they were dealing with murder incorporated, which gets back to my earlier response about Germans and Ukraine. But anyway, all of this is to say that when you're dealing with a country like Russia, and you're dealing with this history, and you're talking about moving a military alliance up to their doorstep, right? You're really asking for trouble.
Here's another question for Professor Mersheimer. Please comment on the economic aspects, and do we have a clear move by the U.S. to establish global economic dominance?
I'll answer that question, but before I do, I just want to make a point regarding the previous question. There's a new book out by Michael Glennon, G-L-E-N-N-O-N. He teaches at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. You can go to his website, and he has an article on the website that is effectively a manuscript version of the book. It's published by a Harvard journal, like the Harvard Journal of National Security Affairs, if you don't want to buy the book. It's a terribly important book, and it deals with what I call the deep government. And he raises the question at the front of the book, why is it that Barack Obama, who came to office promising to have a completely different foreign policy from George W. Bush, has really acted pretty much the way George W. Bush acted, and in some cases has been worse than George W. Bush, right? Why do they look like Tweedledee and Tweedledum on the foreign policy front? This is his question. And his argument, this is my rhetoric, is because of the deep state. Right? Presidents come and go, but the deep state remains intact. And it is really a fascinating book, and it would be well worth your reading. And for those who are interested in this whole issue of how much presidents really matter. With regard to your question about economics, look, I think the United States has a deep-seated interest in being the dominant economic power on the planet. There's no question about that. It's what's made the United States so powerful. And I think the main reason, to get back to this woman's question in the rear, that we're so worried about the Chinese these days is because we hypothesize a situation where China becomes a giant Hong Kong. In other words, it has a per capita GNP like Hong Kong. And given that it's going to have about four times as many people as us in the year 2050, if it has a per capita GNP like Hong Kong, oh my God, it's going to be much more powerful than the United States. So the United States does care, apropos your question about American dominance. But the United States is not interested in going around the world and wrecking the Russian economy, wrecking the Ukrainian economy, wrecking the European economy. And in fact, for us to remain really filthy rich in the years ahead, it's very important that these other economies prosper as well. Okay? So, for example, there was no evidence that we were out to undermine Russia's economy before February 22, 2014. And we have no interest whatsoever in wrecking Ukraine's economy, and certainly the West European economies, the EU. Okay. Now, with regard to the Ukraine crisis, in 2013, remember I told you that what got this whole ball rolling in the fall of 2013 was that the president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, was negotiating with the EU to concoct an economic deal that would benefit Ukraine. In the end, Yanukovych abandoned that deal, and he went with the Russian deal, the deal that Putin was putting forward. Putin actually had been saying all along, don't make it an either-or choice for the Ukrainians. The EU was making it an either-or choice. You either go with us or you go with the Russians. Putin was saying, don't do that. The Russians, the EU, the IMF, and the United States can all work together to make Ukraine prosperous. The fact is that Putin has a deep-seated interest in making Ukraine into a prosperous country. He doesn't want it to be part of the West, but he wants it to be prosperous because it's in Russia's economic interest to have a neighbor that is economically successful. And it, as I said before, is in the interest of the West Europeans, of the European Union, to have a prosperous Ukraine and also to have a prosperous Russia. The Germans export huge amounts of products to Russia. They don't want the Russian economy to go in the toilet. They want the Russian economy to prosper. They want Russian consumers to have lots of money so that they can buy German Audis or German Volkswagens or what have you. Everybody has a vested interest, right, in being rich in the story, and that includes the United States. So I don't see the United States, absent this crisis, doing things that are designed or pursuing policies that are designed to hurt those economies. The Chinese is a different story, right? The Chinese economy is a different story. I believe if we, down the road, have the opportunity to damage the Chinese economy, we would take advantage of that because they have the potential to become Godzilla. And the United States will not be happy about that.
That was John Mersheimer, professor of political science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. Thanks to Dale Lehman for the January 10, 2015 recording. He's a member of the group Neighbors for Peace that organized the event. Dale is also the news director of WZRD Radio in Chicago. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.